Transportation and Workforce Development. And we have, because of our lateness on the floor today, we have a couple of members that will be coming in, so, but we're going to go ahead and get started. A little information about today's schedule. We are going to start the public hearing on Senate Bill 465, and we're going to continue that hearing until 5 minutes after 2 o'clock. That will be the cutoff time. And then at 5 after 2, we will spend the last hour reviewing Connect Oregon. So for those of you who have interest in one of those and not both, we will keep to that schedule so you can adjust accordingly. We have, what I'm going to do, I'm going to move around a little bit on my witness list on Senate Bill 465 to accommodate a couple people, and then we'll go through that and, until our time of hearing the arguments. And I would begin by opening public hearing on Senate Bill 465, and Janet, if you would give us a brief explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 465 would provide that nothing in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act would preclude an employer from establishing or enforcing a policy to achieve or maintain a drug-free workforce. It also would provide that employers are not required to accommodate the use of medical marijuana and provides that employers are not required to either allow an employee or an independent contractor to possess, consume, or be impaired by the use of marijuana during working hours or to, if they are impaired by the use, to remain in the workplace. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. And this bill came to us from the Interim Committee on Judiciary from the Drug-Free Workplace Legislative Work Group. And I'll open by asking Julie Cushing for the Oregon Partnership to come forward, because Julie needs to leave in a few minutes, and then we will go with Senator Prezansky and go through our list. Welcome. Just go ahead and... Welcome.
Thank you. Hello. Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Judy Cushing, and I'm president and CEO of the Oregon Partnership, a statewide nonprofit dedicated to alcohol and drug prevention and treatment referral. We at Oregon Partnership wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 465 and believe that its provisions would ensure a drug-free workplace for Oregonians. Employees, not to mention customers and employers, certainly deserve a work environment that is safe and healthy, and one that is protected by Oregon law. We don't believe right now that that is the case. Certainly, employers should have the ability to prevent anyone in the workforce from being impaired from marijuana use, particularly those who are in positions that have safety-related positions, but as well as in other jobs as well. And we know that marijuana has some very serious and detrimental effects on people, and it can have long-term impact and sometimes unintended consequences. There are people in this room you will hear today who know a lot more about this than I do, but I will tell you from our perspective, the public simply doesn't understand the marijuana of today and how quickly and severely people can become impaired in their jobs. Allowing marijuana to be used in the workplace could have very, very dangerous consequences, and we just urge you to support this bill and take into consideration the ramifications for not only other employees but customers of establishments as well.
Thank you, Ms. Cushing. Any questions for Ms. Cushing? Just briefly, could you tell us a little about your coalition, about who Oregon Partnership is? Because we have TV audiences out here as well.
Oh, okay.
Watching,
Well, Oregon Partnership is functions statewide as a nonprofit. We provide alcohol and drug prevention education in classrooms. We do a lot of work with parents. We work with businesses if they are don't have an EAP program and want to find a way to refer their employees to help. We run 24-hour crisis lines. We operate the only suicide prevention line in Oregon, and those lines are staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We do a lot of work with young people around using the voices of young people and giving them the skills to actually create ads, create documentaries, to do various, allow their own creativity to bring the drug prevention message forward. We also work with community coalitions around the state and support the work of people like Shirley Morgan and others who are doing fantastic work to educate and mobilize citizens on drug issues locally. We have been involved. We have a number of people from the business community, the law enforcement community, and the medical community on our board. We hear firsthand some of the results of people who are impaired from marijuana use. We're particularly concerned what we're hearing from OHSU and other partners about what's happening with young people who are using marijuana early and often and what is happening to their brain. So our job is to educate the public and to keep people informed and keep this issue in front of you all.
Thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time to come.
Thank you.
Senator Frzanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, Senate District 4. I'm here to give some concern or raise some concerns about Senate Bill 465 as it's currently written. But before doing so, I think it's important for the committee to, let's say, maybe have a walk down memory lane just a little bit as to how medical marijuana became a component within the Oregon statutes. It was approved by the voters back in 1998. It was an initiative that the voters passed stating that they felt that under certain circumstances marijuana could be used by individuals if they were received from their doctor some type of authorization. As most of the panel knows, that under the current law, because it is a Schedule I drug, it cannot be prescribed as many other type of medicines are. Going into my concerns with 465, it appears to try to single out medical marijuana differently from any other type of medication that may be prescribed by a doctor for a worker in a workplace. I would ask you to look at a couple of components in the bill that as it's been written and proposed, and ask you to consider maybe modifying it, because I do believe there are a couple of components to it that are would be giving more clarity and making certain that we do in fact have a work site that would be in fact not impaired by individuals that are under the influence of not only medical marijuana but any other type of drug or any other type of substance that would in fact impair them. You have to realize that there's a number of types of substances that may even be legal over the counter that can in fact cause impairment. We've heard from the Oregon Partnership as to their work in dealing not only with drug but also alcohol. And so clearly all of us want to make certain that we have a workplace that's free and safe for all in involved or that come in contact with it. But I'll direct your attention to line 9 under section 2A for the new language, where it says regardless where the use occurs. I'm not sure what the history is going to be as to what that would include, but if it does in fact include an individual that has received a medical marijuana card, that they would not be able to use their medicine outside of the workplace at home, then I would ask you to consider whether or not whether you want to keep that in the bill, because it seems like it would actually defeat the purpose of why they actually are able to have access to the medicine. Regarding lines 11 through 13, which are 2B and 2C, I would strongly support and ask you to keep those portions into the bill, because that does, in fact, allow for the employer to make certain that employees, independent contractors, are not allowed to possess, consume, or, more importantly, probably impaired or be impaired by the use of marijuana during the working hours. That is what we're trying to save. That's what we're trying to focus on. And I believe that that will give much more clarity for the employers to be able to take the steps, which I hope they're already taking, not only with individuals that could be under the influence of marijuana, but also alcohol or any other type of substance that could cause a health concern or a safety concern for those individuals and those around them. Also C, which is allows any person who is impaired by the use of marijuana to remain on the workplace. This would basically should stay in the bill as well. That makes it very clear that the employer has the right to remove that individual if they are in fact impaired while they're at the workplace. The last of the bill, which is new, is subsection 3, lines 15 through 16. I again would caution the committee as to limiting it to that one portion or that one statement. For the interest of the committee members and my committee in Commerce, we have another bill that's already been assigned to it. It's Senate Bill 423. And what you may want to do is look at the language that's in 423 and actually take part of that and put it into your sub 3. 423 was sponsored by one of your members, Senator Deckard, at the request of one of his constituents. And it basically says that a person cannot be discriminated against in the workplace just because they have medical use of marijuana available to them. And so if you look at the language that's within Senate Bill 423, Section 3, starting on line 14, it starts with the however, and it goes into the part where it basically says that an employer may not discriminate against a person with respect to hire or tenure or any term or condition of employment because the person engages in the medical use of marijuana outside of the workplace. So I would ask you to take those thoughts in consideration as you're deliberating on Senate Bill 465. I will state once again that I, as well as many other people, and most, I would think, all in this room, believe we want to accomplish the same goal. That goal is to make certain that we have a workplace that is free of individuals of being impaired by whatever the substance may be it marijuana, be it alcohol, be it some other type of controlled substance, or some other over-the-counter drug, because we know that it's important and vital that we have a safe workplace for those workers as well as their coworkers and for the general public that would be in contact with them at their workplace.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. That was very helpful. Questions? Senator Mossander.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not sure if this was covered in any of your hearings, but, you know, marijuana stays in the system for an extremely long time, up to a month. I'm not sure how do you envision someone determining whether a person is impaired or not. Methamphetamines can get out of the system pretty quickly. So I two thoughts. One, regarding your on lines 9 and 10, regardless of where the use occurs. But do you have any thoughts on screening?
Do. Yeah. I do. Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, regarding how impairment can be detected, currently that is being done in the criminal field. As most of you know, my day job outside of being a legislator is a prosecutor. And driving under the influence of intoxicants include multiple types of drugs or substances that could put someone under the influence. And we do, in fact, have individuals who are trained to be able to recognize where someone is actually under the influence. You are correct, based on the studies and the information that has been provided to me, marijuana is one of those substances that does have residual in the body for some period of time, whatever length that may be. And that, I would submit to you, is probably not the way to test as to whether there's something within the system as much as what is in the system is actually causing some type of impairment. And clearly it's occurring now through the criminal justice system. And I believe that individuals can, in fact, be detected and are detected when they are, in fact, under the influence of whatever the substance may be, and that they are impaired to the point that they, under the, 465, would be able to be removed from the workplace based on that impairment.
Any other questions from the Senator? Senator Deckard.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And so I have naivety in terms of our lack of good information in terms of employment laws. It's certainly not my expertise. But it seems to me, and I was just handed the bill that a constituent asked me to introduce, and I recall speaking with this constituent, and it seemed to me, and they had a pretty good case of if they voters pass this law, they hold a medical marijuana card, that they shouldn't be able to be fired simply for that offense. Because they're complying with the state law that the voters passed. If you subtract out the two items that you suggested, Senator Prusansky, and you added in the language that's in Senate Bill 423. Aren't they at odds with each other? And maybe you have to define what type of activities, heavy machinery,
children,
bus driver, that type. And maybe there's a section of employment law that really just clearly states these types of occupations, which tend to be ones that that involved heavy machinery or children or other areas.
Now, let me try to respond to your question as to the two areas that I suggest that you strike from the bill. The first one seems to go directly to anyone that would have a medical marijuana card using it anywhere in their 24-hour day period, including or excluding the workplace. So that would mean anywhere outside of the workplace. And that seems to go contrary to what the voters have approved to allow for that to be a source for people to seek, I guess, relief from whatever symptoms they have that qualify them to get the card. Regarding lines 15 and 16, sub 3, I was not asking that you would exclude or, let's say, delete that line and put in the other language, but instead you could leave what is there and then add the other language. And basically what it would say is that an individual employer would be able to have a policy to achieve and maintain a drug-free workforce, but they would not be able to not they would be prohibited from keeping someone from working there just exclusively because they had a medical marijuana card. And that's basically what I think is the crux of your constituents' request in Senate Bill 423, is that they wanted to make certain that just because they hold the card, that that in itself would keep them from having employment or retaining employment at a specific position that they would be qualified. In answer to your third part as to setting standards for the type of work that is being done by anybody, I would hope that employers are already doing that for each and every individual and the type of job and safety concerns that they may have regarding their ability for them to have, I guess, not only the expertise to operate the equipment, but also are in a safe means or mindset to be able to actually accomplish the job. Now, clearly, I don't think there's anything that would keep an individual employer from requiring all employees to tell their employer what medications they are under, and at that point, I think the employer would be in a position to determine, based on the type of medication that they are consuming and the type of frequency or whatever it may be, as to what their limitations should be as to the type of work they would be allowed to perform in the general public or on the private work site that could be hazardous not only to the individual patient, worker, but also for those around them.
I'm going to thank you, Senator. Senator Johnson is here, who's in committee, and then I'm going to ask her to come forward, and then we'll go to our list and begin our rest of the public testimony. Thank you, Senator Prusansky. That was helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. I didn't realize you were going to hear this bill today, so I'm going to be very brief as I do not have a sheaf of prepared testimony. Right from the get-go, I want to disclose a bias that brings me to my support of this bill. More years ago and more pounds ago than I want to count, I spent 20 years as a professional commercial helicopter pilot. It is a zero tolerance for drugs industry. I was routinely drug tested and welcome drug testing in the workplace to assure the safe operation in the kind of very dangerous work we were doing. We were the prime contractor of the U.S. Geological Survey on Mount St. Helens for better than 10 years. We set all the original seismometers. We worked construction sites. We had to operate in an environment where we were absolutely assured that our own crews and the people working underneath the helicopters were in tip-top condition to perform that work. So it is against that backdrop that I have to come here and respectfully acknowledge that I understand that there are some people who may be helped by medical marijuana. I can't go so far as to call it medicine. It's medical marijuana. I also am extremely cognizant of the scourge of drugs in our community and our workplace. I have an employer in my district who had, as a condition of employment, taking a drug test. And he had, for jobs that were in the woods, high-paying jobs, good benefits, good retirement, he had 9 people in 10 applicants flunk the drug test. He finally had to stop doing the drug test as part of the employment procedure because it became a cost center for him. So many people were flunking. So he went to a policy that if you passed the drug test and if you were hired, that then you'd be reimbursed for the cost of the drug test. So I am having a very difficult time reconciling the amount of money and effort that is expended in this building to try to build workforce, to try to develop the kind of workforce that can compete in a global economy, and on the same hand, doing everything we can to try to accommodate a workforce that has access to drugs that could impair their safe, if not their performance in total, at the workplace. I just came really to shine a little light on my perception of the inherent hypocrisy of trying to create workforce, put people to work, and simultaneously accommodate drug use at the workplace. It seems to be completely contradictory to me. And so as an employer, as someone who worked in a zero-tolerance industry, I come in support of this bill and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Johnson? Thank you very much for taking the time to come.
Thank you.
Now, as I mentioned, I have the list before me, and so that everybody, I'm going to try to accommodate everybody, but the time will run out, so think of, when you're testifying, keep in mind that if I start looking like you're going over your time, that means you're going over the time of the other person who's not going to be able to testify. So I'm going to ask, that because I try to get people in, we can, but we also are limited. I'm going to ask each of you to, on the list here, as I did my math, to try and keep your march to 3 minutes. So we can have the next person testify. I'm going to try to balance the pros and cons based on my sheet, and we'll go from there. I'd like to have Dan Harmon come forward. I believe Dan and Lisa's coming up as well. Dan represents the head of this work group, I understand, from which this bill came. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan Harmon. I'm Executive Vice President, General Counsel of Hoffman Construction Company in Portland, Oregon. I'm also Vice Chairman of the AOI Board of Directors. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity they've given me to testify in support of Senate Bill 465. I must tell you at the outset that I voted for the medical marijuana measure, and I strongly support the right of seriously ill people to use medical marijuana. In fact, I've personally encountered situations in my life where that has brought some comfort to those I care about a lot. Originally, when the voters passed this measure, there was a compact of sorts. The compact was that there would be very few people with very debilitating illnesses who would use small amounts of marijuana in certain circumstances. And the other part of the compact was there would be so few of them that it wouldn't be necessary for employers to accommodate them in the workplace. Unfortunately, the former part of the compact has not been implemented, really. Today, there are 19,000 folks in the state of Oregon with medical marijuana cards. 19,000. 12,000 patients, around 7,000 caregivers. That's not a few. And they can retain up to 2 pounds. Do the math, that's about 20 tons of marijuana, a lot. It's the second part of the compact, lack of the employer's obligation to accommodate that we're talking about today. And I think there are 4 reasons why you should support this bill. The first is that the employer's obligations are currently unsettled. There were 2 cases recently. One was Washburn versus Columbia Forest Products. You may be familiar with that. In that case, the Supreme Court determined that the employee was not disabled and chose not to go beyond that to determine whether or not an accommodation was required. However, it is instructive to read Justice Kistler's concurring opinion, where he comes down very clearly and says that if an employer in the state of Oregon, if the state moves to require that an employer accommodate medical marijuana, they will be squarely in conflict with the preemption document policies and doctrines of the United States as it relates to the Controlled Substances Act. The second case was Emerald Steel Fabricators, the Emerald Steel Fabricators case, which is a case that of employment discrimination through bully. There was an order that came out that determined basically there was an obligation on the part of an employer to enter into a meaningful dialogue about a reasonable accommodation. The labor commissioner awarded lost wages and $20,000 in emotional distress damages. That case is on appeal. So you can see there's some conflict about where this all goes. The state really needs your clarification here and should make it infinitely clear that the original compact is being honored. In no circumstances should employers be required to accommodate medical marijuana, regardless of where its use occurs. The second reason is the failure of this legislature to support this bill, I think, will lead to a major legal collision that will lead to challenges, as predicted by Justice Kessler, based on federal law preemption of the Controlled Substances Act, which could lead to the collapse of the entire medical marijuana approach. And I think that'd be a shame for those folks who seriously need it. The third reason is requiring Oregon employers to accommodate medical marijuana will place them in the position of being non-compliant with federal drug testing laws from the Department of Defense, the Department of Transportation, and the federal drug-free workplace programs, and will jeopardize Oregon employers, such as Hoffman's, ability to do federal contracting work. The fourth reason is simply this. Medical marijuana cannot be safely accommodated in the workplace. Although certain advocates will try to persuade you that marijuana is safe or can be accommodated, that is simply intellectually dishonest. It is not safe. I grew up in the era of marijuana, and when users used it, they said, we're going to get stoned and we're going to get high, and they did for good reason. The National Institute of Drug Abuse reports scientists have learned a great deal about how THC acts in the brain to produce its many effects. The short-term effects of marijuana can include problems with memory, learning, disoriented perception, difficulty in thinking, problem solving, loss of coordination, increased heart rates, and there are long-term impacts. These effects affect the individual's ability to work safely and productively. Like many employers, we see the results in our accidents. Over the past 10 years, we've conducted nearly 200,000 pre-employment drug screens. The failure rate in the state of Oregon is about 6%. Marijuana constitutes about 45% of those failures. So marijuana is failing at a rate of about 3%. More importantly, though, the accidents. In the last 10 years, we've had 250 accidents in Oregon that have involved drugs and alcohol and injury to that individual or his coworkers or property damage. Of those accidents, 36% or 90 involve marijuana. Many people have been hurt, but fortunately no one's been killed. A combination of medical marijuana would undermine the efforts to implement a consistent drug testing program and is opposed by both the employers and the workers who want to be safe. Requiring us to accommodate marijuana would undermine those efforts, obviously, and I think infringes on both our rights and the workers' rights to a safe workplace. A couple of other comments quickly. It is impossible for our folks to determine impairment. It's in the field. Absolutely impossible. And if you think about it, the folks that are using medical marijuana are using it to offset some sort of medical condition. It's constant use. It is not intermittent use. It is constant use and should be for those people that are seriously ill. That's the end of my comment.
Thank you, Mr. Harvey. I'm going to go right to Ms. Trussell and then.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here, and I'll just concur with Mr. Harmon's comments because he covered the points I wanted to make.
Thank you very much for that brevity. Questions, though, of the committee for either of these two witnesses? Senator Montes-Anderson.
Yeah. Do you know of any individual that was known to have been using medical marijuana and was impaired at work? I mean, I know alcohol, meth, but I was just wondering if there are individual circumstances where medical marijuana was proven to cause an impairment at work.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss Anderson, we have not yet had a case where a medical marijuana card user has been presented to us where we've allowed them to remain on the job site. Thank you. Period.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Decker.
Somewhere, and I don't expect you to notice, although maybe our staff does, a number of states, and I just don't know how many, have passed initiatives similar to this, I believe. And so somehow they, you would think, I would guess, and I don't know how early on we were or how late we were in terms of passing this, but you would think they've sorted this issue out as to what are the rights of the person that obtains the card and what are the rights of employers and how do those intercede. And you'd also think the courts have weighed in settling this issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, the area that I'm most, or the state that I'm most familiar with is Colorado. Colorado has a similar statute. They have about 550 cardholders, as I understand it, versus our 19,000. The second part of it is they, too, do not require an employer to accommodate. And I think because they have so few, they don't require them to accommodate. And in the state of Oregon, under the current law, as the statute's framed, an employer could accommodate. It just doesn't require an employer to accommodate. And I know of firms that are out there, and I'm sure they are in Colorado too, that are have made the choice in their circumstances to accommodate and allow the use.
Question? Senator Starr.
Do you know what year the Colorado statute was put into place?
Chairman Messner, Senator Starr. I'm not aware. I can't recall, honestly.
Okay, yeah. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to ask Leland Berger and Andrea Meyer, who were signed up in opposition, to come forward, trying to keep our little back and forth here going. We did good. We did 6.5 minutes between those two, other than our questions. So,
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, in today in strong opposition to Senate Bill 465. This is the same bill that you had last session that died in committee. This bill would undermine the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act that was approved by voters in 1998 that you heard earlier today. The purpose of OMMA was to permit Oregonians suffering from debilitating medical conditions to be able to use marijuana to relieve their symptoms without being in violation of Oregon criminal law. There are many OMMA patients whose symptoms can be adequately relieved by occasional use of marijuana, and as a result, they are able to be productive employees. The same is true for thousands of other Oregon employees who rely on prescription medications containing other controlled substances that could potentially affect their performance on the job. Unfortunately, because federal authorities continue to insist on treating marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substance, it is not possible for Oregon law to permit physicians to write prescriptions for the medical use of marijuana as they do for medications containing codeine, amphetamines, or morphine. Urine analysis drug testing does not indicate impairment, and that's the method that's most frequently used. There's no connection between the presence of metabolites of THC in the urine and actual impairment. THC metabolites end up in the fat cells and are retained in the body for 30 days or longer, Senator Moniz Anderson spoke about earlier. As a result, the metabolites, and I think I'm mispronouncing that.
Metabolites.
Metabolites, thank you, can still be present in urine well after the ingestion of marijuana. Senate Bill 465 allows an employer to ban someone from the workplace who is never impaired in the workplace by the use of medical marijuana off the job. Yet the same policies could permit other workers who are impaired, but whose medication is prescribed by a physician to continue working. This is fundamentally an unfair and bad policy. Employer policies focus on whether employees are impaired on the job, rather than their conduct during non-work hours that has no negative effect on the employee's job performance. If an employee presents at the job with actual evidence of impairment, regardless of the cause, it could be for prescription drugs, it could be for alcohol, it could be for great emotional distress, an employer should be able to remove the employee until he or she is no longer a threat to the safety of other workers or the public. The best way for employers to do this is to engage in regular performance-based testing rather than relying on urine analysis. ACLU does not oppose the use of performance-based testing, and there are firms that have created computer programs and video games that test a person's reflexes and hand-eye coordination. And if someone is using heavy equipment, they should be tested using that technology, because the issue shouldn't be what medicines they are on. The issue should be whether they present with an impairment, whatever the cause. No worker should be removed merely because he or she suffers from a debilitating medical condition and lawfully uses medical marijuana when the condition has no bearing on the ability to perform the job. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we'll go to our next witness, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I live and work in Senator Carter and Representative Shields' district in Northeast Portland. I submitted written testimony for myself, also for Sandy Burbank, who is the acting chair of the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, a committee that I serve on as well. And I know that Laird Funk from Williams has sent an email to Ms. Adkins that I hope has been distributed to the committee as well. Marijuana is medicine. It's not actually an opinion. It's the law. Oregon Revised Statutes 475-300 sub 1 includes the finding by the people that patients and doctors have found marijuana to be an effective treatment for suffering caused by debilitating medical conditions, and therefore marijuana should be treated like other medicines. Should be treated like other medicines because it actually is medicine. And the refusal of AOI, the refusal of the drug partnership, and its the Drug Enforcement Agency, which is a member of the drug partnership, is the crux of the problem here. And the solutions that are proposed in Senate Bill 465 would have the effect of allowing employers to discriminate against patients simply because of their status as registered patients. That's wrong. The most interesting part of this hearing so far to me is there have been two interesting parts. One is Senator Manas Anderson's question of Mr. Harden? Is that his name?
Harmon.
Harmon, about whether there have been any workplace injuries caused by a medical marijuana patient, and if there had been, he'd have told you that there had been, and that he wasn't able to answer the question because there hasn't been. He says that there's no intermittent use. Robert Washburn, in Washburn, the plaintiff in the Washburn case, smoked a little before he went to bed at night. That was the testimony in that case. He used it to, he qualified because he had severe pain, but he used it, as many patients do, for insomnia. Chief Justice DeMunis, during an oral argument, said that he hadn't had a good night's sleep since he got back from Vietnam, and I think because of that, the Supreme Court decided that, in part because of that, the Supreme Court decided that that kind of use isn't a disability that's required to be accommodated under the Oregonians with Disabilities Act, which has a lockstep provision that requires it follow the American with Disabilities Act. Justice Kistler, and only Justice Kistler, took the position that to require employers to accommodate would conflict with the Controlled Substances Act. He's wrong, but that's not what's going on here. I was kind of surprised to hear Mr. Harmon's testimony. It sounded like there was a bill that employers shall be required to accommodate. Employers aren't required to accommodate. That's what the law is. And it just seemed to me that that Senate Bill 465 is a solution in search of a problem. To the extent that the problem is that employers are uncomfortable about knowing whether workers are impaired or not, and as Mr. Harmon said, that they are unable to test whether they are impaired or not. You've heard from Senator Prezansky, who professionally is a prosecutor. My profession is a criminal defense lawyer, and as an aside, I encourage you, if you're ever in Newport and late to get to Coos Bay, to slow down when you go through Florence. Otherwise, if you fight the speeding ticket, you get to face off with Senator Prezansky in court, and it's not a pleasant experience. The fact is that there is a crime in Oregon called driving under the influence of intoxicants. It includes driving under the influence of controlled substances. There is a protocol called the drug recognition exam that people are licensed to give. It is a 12-step program, which is interesting given the subject matter, but there are 12 steps to be able to, for a drug recognition expert to be able to offer an expert opinion about it, and if employers wanted to employ that, they could. The problem with the regardless of where the use occurs is when, again, as I indicated, there are many patients whose use is intermittent and off-site. The problem with leaving in this part that Senator Prozanski encourages you to leave in is the possession part, which is that what if a patient, you know, there is no licensed and regulated dispensary system under the current law. Senator Marcet has submitted a bill to legislative council that would create a state garden, and Representative Shields has submitted a bill to legislative council that would create licensed and regulated dispensaries. So maybe we'll get one out of this session. But in the meantime, a patient either has to cultivate for him or herself or has to find somebody to cultivate for them. What if they met the person who was cultivating for them during their lunch break at work? What if that's the only time that they have the opportunity to do that? In terms of the drug-free workforce, you know, that I think that is a conflict between state law and federal law. I understood what Mr. Harmon was talking about. I get calls like that from patients who want to work at places that contract with the federal government, and they're unable to do so because the federal government requires this. And I don't think there's anything, frankly, the state legislature can do. But again, the law says that nothing in the Medical Marijuana Act requires an employer to accommodate the medical use of marijuana in the workplace. And that includes allowing anybody impaired to be at the work site. There isn't any need for additional legislation. It's not broke. It doesn't need to be fixed. I did want to respond to Senator Deckert's question and to Senator Starr's question really briefly. There is a case pending in California on this issue, I think, in the California Supreme Court relating to employers and medical marijuana in the workplace. Senator Starr, I don't know the date of the Colorado initiative, but I know it was after Oregon. I know it was a constitutional amendment. There's currently 11 states nationally that where people are, to one extent or the other, protected from arrest, prosecution, and forfeiture, which ultimately are the worst side effects of the use of marijuana. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Just briefly, yes. I think the problem we have here is impairment. As a nurse, I only work with patients who were really, really sick, and they definitely needed marijuana. I didn't know patients who just used it to relieve some pain and then go to work. I just never had those kinds of patients, and maybe there are some, and I think that was the true intent. I have observed, though, people who have used marijuana, and I don't think they need to use them medically, and there is an impairment. They're stoned, and so there's the rub, and that's what we're having to wrestle with, I think.
Senator Metzger, Senator Montes Anderson, I mentioned in my written testimony that most registered medical marijuana patients use therapeutic cannabis to treat severe pain as an alternative to strong analgesics like OxyContin or Valium. They also report that they prefer cannabis because it does not impair them while conventional pharmaceuticals do. I'm not saying that nobody that uses medical cannabis that everybody who uses medical marijuana is not impaired. Certainly some people are impaired. Certainly there is a period of time. But if we're going to treat marijuana like any other medicine, which is what we're obligated to do under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, then we need to leave it to the patient to not use or to use far enough in advance so that the effects have worn off, but he's still able to work, at least as to those patients who are capable of working.
Okay, thank
just
you.
I'm
going to exercise the privilege here. Thank you very much, because we're 15 minutes left, and some people aren't going to make it now. So I want to get as much hearing from the audience as possible. I apologize for that. So we got Shirley Morgan, Jessica Adamson, and Bob Shifrak. Why don't all three of you come forward? If you do have written testimony to turn that in, that's good, because we'll have this, because we'll be bringing the bill back after today. But
Shipwreck will keep us here all day.
I want to hear everything as much as we can in this time frame. Shirley, welcome. Glad to see someone from Welch's.
Yes, thank you. Hi, yeah. Senator Metzger and Chair. Honorable Senators, my name is Shirley Morgan. I'm a citizen in an unincorporated rural community at Mount Hood. I have lived next to a suspected drug house for the last 30 years. In 1995, my home was burglarized. In 1998, I found 10 cats and 2 dogs starving to death on this property, took them all in. In 1999, this property decided to cook and traffic methamphetamine and had long been known for their suspected marijuana trafficking. I got an education of a lifetime on the dangers that illegal drugs brings to our communities and to our workplace. And in a proactive effort, citizens in the Mount Hood area created a grassroots coalition called the Mount Hood Coalition Against Drug Crime. I have learned more than I ever wanted to know about the dangers of illegal drugs. Today I come before you because I want you to know that Senate Bill 465 relating to drugs in the workplace is only the beginning to facing the problems that marijuana is posing to communities in this state. Most recently, David and Carla Harvey and their two children, age 6 and 5, moved to Oregon into our community from Montana because we are a medical marijuana state. And they were going to apply for a medical marijuana card, according to Clackamas County Sheriff's Office police records. Within weeks, Carla had a job at a local ski resort as the night auditor. And the following week, they were both arrested by Clackamas County Sheriff's Office for possessing and growing 711 marijuana plants in their new home in Welch's. And their 6 and 5-year-old were removed from their home because of neglect. Carla Harvey pled guilty and was sentenced. David Harvey was sentenced on January 12, 2007 for unlawful manufacture of marijuana, escape 2, assaulting a police officer, child neglect 1, resisting arrest, endangering of the welfare of a minor, and unlawful possession of marijuana with substantial quantity. His intentions were criminal. His facade was medical. I would like to point two closing comments. According to the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, marijuana is a Schedule I substance under the Controlled Substance Act. Schedule I drugs are classified as having a high potential for abuse. No currently accepted medical use and treatment in the United States, and a lack of accepted safety for use of drug or other substances on medical supervision. In the case of United States versus Oakland Cannabis Club, the Supreme Court ruled that marijuana has no medical value as determined by Congress. The opinion of the court stated that, in case of the Controlled Substance Act, the statute reflects a determination that marijuana has no medical benefits worthy of an exception outside the confines of government-approved research projects. What other medicine in history have we ever smoked? In both points, it is clear that marijuana is a dangerous drug and has been designated as such by the Federal Health Administration and the Federal Supreme Court. And as a citizen of this state of Oregon, I did not vote for medical marijuana in 1998. I am the other half. Senate Bill 465 provides safety in the workplace and allows employers who are already taking all the risks and the employees who work for them to be supported in keeping their workplaces drug and safety free. I'm here to support Senate Bill 465.
Thank you, Shirley, and thanks so much for all you've done. She's this magnificent lady here. Mr. Shiprack, who used to be the state representative for Shirley Morgan, put all this history behind us, but now is wearing the hat of the Building Trades Council. Welcome.
I'll be very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I'm here representing union construction workers throughout the state of Oregon. Yes, just yesterday I brought this bill up in front of my executive board where the business manager is representing about 12 different crafts throughout the state unanimously supported the bill. We need some clarity. Right now, we have mandatory drug testing on the job sites for all the crafts. The programs vary, but at the end of the day, you're going to get tested sooner or later. One of the first things a new apprentice is told when they're entering the trade, if you want to smoke pot or use drugs, go find something else to do. We just don't have time to deal with this stuff. The other comments I'd make is in the real world, there was an attempt. This was brought up yesterday. We're actually looking for a very clear line in this. There was an out-of-state contractor who recognized our law and attempted to accommodate, and it just led to friction on the job. When you're dispatched as an iron worker to a job site and you have this card and you're told, well, you don't have to get up in the air because you've got this card, it causes a little problem with the rest of the crew. And I just want, that's some of the realities that I heard about yesterday. So we support the bill. We do need clarity in this area. It's a question my business manager constantly asking me about is, what do you do with these people? And we think this is a good solution. Just one way or the other, this is the one we just pick. Thank you.
Thank you. It's Shipwreck. Ms. Adamson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors and my 1,100 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington that build commercial infrastructure. We strongly support this bill that is a bit of a reprise from last session that was supported by both chambers and unfortunately died in the last final hours. We want to go ahead and support everything that you just heard Mr. Shipwreck say and Mr. Harmon earlier, but add a couple of points. First is the language about where, regardless of where the use occurs, we believe is critical. In the same way that we don't accommodate today alcohol use that occurs off-site, we need this language to clarify that we wouldn't have to accommodate the medical use of marijuana off-site, because the way the court dealt with the issue in Columbia v. Washburn, they took a very narrow view of what in the workplace meant, and literally you would have to be consuming it on-site in order for us to not have to accommodate. And we believe that you could have a situation where somebody consumes immediately before they come to work, and without that language, it would be unclear. And I think the issue of clarity is what is most important here. Additionally, as it relates to the ability to reassign based upon the kinds of crafts that my folks are engaged in, which is heavy construction, it is unclear today, and that is what we're here to get, is clarity. It is unclear today if we can say to somebody, no, you can't go up today. No, you can't work on the job site today. No, you have to sit out for a few hours. We are very concerned, and we get constant calls from HR people saying, if we do this, are we going to face an issue with BOLI? Are we going to be in violation law? And if we don't do this, are we going to be in trouble with our federal contracts? And the answer is, we don't know. So do what's right. Do what your policy says, and go from there. But I think the issue for Oregon employers is we need to know, and we urge you to allow us to protect not only our workers, our owners, but quite frankly the public, because when you're on a highway construction job, if you have somebody out there that that we can't take off of the job site, it's not just us, it's also the public that's in harm's way. And so we just ask for the ability to enforce our policies today and give employers the choice to accommodate or not.
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel for any of our panels?
Just
I
real
have
quick.
One.
Okay, Senator Monsanders and then Senator Decker.
Do you know of any construction workers or building trades workers who have a medical marijuana card?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I don't know off hand, but I do know that there are many folks that have been not allowed to be on the job site because of testing positive for marijuana. We don't always get into with an employee what medications are you on and why are you on those medications. That tends to get into a very sticky place in the law dealing with HIPAA and other piece of information.
Just follow up. There is a difference between marijuana use and those who actually have a medical marijuana card.
I can answer that.
Yeah.
Yes, certainly we have members, union members with these cards, and we don't know what quite to do. Mr. Harmon was, their policies, you're not going to be on our jobs. Not all employers are like that, however. And I also might add, you're not, the people that want to continue using these, they simply find an employer that doesn't drug test. That's easy to find. So that's where they go.
Senator Decker.
Thank you. So that that kind of leads to my confusion. The panel before said, and Bob, you or Mr. Shipwreck, you just mentioned that they don't, if they hold the card, they go to an employer who allows, and I think it was the testimony of the previous panel who said that if an employer does not want one of these folks, whether they hold the card or they test positive, they simply do not hire that person, which seems reasonable
correct.
To me.
That's what Mr. Harmon's policy is, yes.
So,
and I think others.
So I guess what's the problem?
They don't have a job.
The person who holds the card.
Yeah.
But that's their choice.
That is their choice. That's entirely correct. And that's our position, is that you've made a choice. You can either work or, you know, go find an employer that doesn't care.
That doesn't care.
Yeah. When we started drug testing in my local union, 30 members resigned from the union mm-hmm. because they were not going to take drug tests because they didn't want to stop.
So, I'm just trying to discern here where I recall, and it was so, came back vividly here, that my first session voted to criminalize marijuana usage, or we passed something, and it took voters about 40 days, and I guess it gets to the first testimony on this panel, it took them about 40 days to undo that decision that I voted for, and I certainly heard from a ton of people in my community, and they just reversed it. And I guess that's the concern that I have is that, and maybe it's just I'll just listen more closely to future testimony, is if Mr. Harmon can exclude someone, and I would think that's his right and certainly safety issue in his business, then it's just what problem are we solving by passing this statute? And I don't know if the sponsors of this initiative are in here, but the second question to them would be, are they going to quickly just go out and undo any decision like we had undone previously when we acted on this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I would certainly hope that the latter wouldn't occur, but as to what problem we're solving here, I think there, when the first case that Mr. Harmon mentioned, Washburn v. Columbia Forest Products, when that case occurred, there became a question about whether an employer could do what Mr. Harmon does and whether we can say we will not accommodate it. And so right now we're in this very gray, murky area where employers don't know. And there are a lot of cases kind of working their way through right now, one that's up on appeal from Boley that Mr. Harmon mentioned, that we will be resigned to a situation where Boley and the courts are going to be fleshing this out without clarity from the legislature on what the policy is. So we can wait for a series of court cases to define what is and what isn't, or the legislature can clarify, and we believe it's important for employers to be able to do what they're doing now, making the choice, without this uncertainty about whether or not they can actually do that.
Thank you very much. Okay, if we're lucky, we'll get our last two folks in. Jeff Dean and Nathan, is it Little? If I'm wrong on that, I apologize. Excuse me? Thank you.
That's Mr. Little.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Little. So written testimony for Mr. Little. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Dean. I work for the Associated Builders and Contractors. I just want to come up here, and you've heard a lot of fantastic testimony in support of this. We are supporting this measure. I would concur with almost everything that you've heard for the reasons why you should support this. And again, just simply emphasize that what this bill is about is safety on the construction job site. Job sites are an inherently dangerous place, and this we've heard a lot of testimony about the individual's right to engage in this medical marijuana, but I'd just like to add the final point that it's not just about the individual, it's about the safety of everybody on the job site, and they have just as much of a right to be safe as the individual does to use this law. So with that, I'd be glad to follow up with any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Dean? Okay. Thank you very much. Members, what we're going to do here, would ask us all to read all the written material that has been provided for us, contemplate some of the comments. The chair is very supportive of this legislation. I believe it is important for two reasons. The one that was articulated a moment ago primarily is clarity. I mean, yes, people are doing things, but they're in an unclear legal environment, and I think we owe them clarity. The second thing is I think it is very, very important that it be clear that employers have a right to set the rules in their own workplace. I found very interesting some of the comments by our colleague, Senator Prozanski, and we'll look at some of his comments on that and see if there may be ways in which we can make the bill clearer and responsive, and we'll do that. And if you have some suggestions, colleagues, on that, please, you know, provide them. We definitely would like to provide the best possible piece of legislation so it is clear and we don't have this again. And I'll just make one other clarifying before we clear the docket of this measure for today. So I know there was one comment about, you know, how the bill failed last session. The history of the bill is that it did win a supermajority vote passage in the House of Representatives last year. So I think there's a lot of interest in this. I think above all, though, we owe employers and employees clarity. We'll be bringing this back later. And if you have any comments, yes, Janet, you have a comment?
I just wanted to enter two phone calls in opposition to the bill to the record. Madeline Martinez and Javier Small Leonard opposed the bill.
Thank you very much. And then all the other submitted testimony will be part of the record. With that, we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 465. Right on time. That's good. Mm-hmm. Thank you all. On Connect Oregon. Okay. And as we shuffle, thank you all for coming. Now we're going to talk transportation. As soon as the people outside shuffle,
everyone can leave.
Senator Metzger, I certainly enjoy the weekly Democrat.
Well, they're coming forward. You want to find out if members are planning to go? Just another announcement about Friday and no meeting tomorrow.
Oh, yes, all right. Okay. Sure, absolutely.
Actually, you can get my address from...
Yeah, Adam's good.
Thank you. Oh, sorry.
Okay. So, now that we have done the seat shift, members, the purpose of this informational hearing, the last part of our meeting today, as you know, there is a bill regarding Connect Oregon, which was a piece of legislation we did last session to try and help other parts of our transportation system other than our roads, which are restricted to the highway fund, and those other areas, ports, aviation, rail, that are not able to be utilized by the highway fund but are important intermodal links to our transportation system. And there was a lot of, I think, good thing work that was done on that last session. We're preparing to move ahead to another version of that. And one thing I think is really, really important is that we ensure that the projects that do go forward continue to have excellent connectivity to our state, and that I thought, since the bill is in the House and could go to Ways and Means without policy review of this committee, which I hope will not happen, but I thought the first thing we should do is allow you to have an input of what has happened with Connect One, and having heard that process questions, if it raises some questions for you, I want our committee to be able to participate in that input while we are still in the piecing together the legislation in the House. So with that, I'd like to ask that Stuart Foster, Chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission, Matthew Garrett, who is the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and Martin Callery for the Port of Coos Bay to come forward. Welcome. And what I've asked before Mr. Foster begins is to give us an overview of background on the process that that was utilized for Connect Oregon 1, and hopefully that will elicit some questions from the committee. So welcome, Mr. Foster.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you know, the 2000 legislature approved which I'm now calling Connect Oregon 1, which was a bill proposed by the governor for $100 million in lottery bonds to fund public and private grants and loans, or grants and loans to public and private entities for aviation, rail, marine, and public transit. The bill provided that the funds should be leveraged, and as a result of leveraging, in fact, there was an additional $129 million worth of additional funds committed to these projects. And that is that 129 is a I would characterize it as a minimum amount. For example, on the Hinkle Yard in Morrill County, that was a $3.7 million grant for Union Pacific, and Union Pacific was obligated to put in $744,000, their 20% grant. They've indicated to us that they're moving their investment schedule up 10 years, and as a result of Connect Oregon, that they, in fact, as part of this project, will invest an additional $5.7 million. So there really have been some leverages here that go beyond the numbers that you've seen in the document before you. The governor has now proposed a Connect Oregon 2, House Bill 2278, for an additional $100 million in bonding. Connect Oregon allocated had minimum allocations to five different regions of the state of 15%, which added up to $75 million, with an additional $25 million that could be allocated statewide. There were criteria in Connect Oregon 1. Those criteria, in addition to the geographic distribution, was that the projects that we should consider projects that reduce transportation costs for Oregon business, connected two or more modes, were critical transportation links regionally or statewide, created construction or permanent Oregon jobs, were project ready for construction, and also the leverage issue that I've just talked about. We had 103 applications for $238 million. There were 90 after the initial screening for eligibility. There were 99 applications that stayed in the pool, and then what we call our super acts, which were, we have our area commissions on transportation, and typically we have a number of them within each region, and so the area commissions on transportation within each region met together and created what we, for convenience term, called the Super Act to make their regional recommendations, as well as the modal committees made their recommendations, rail, transit, aviation, and the Freight Advisory Committee. The governor signed the bill into law on August 28th, 2005, and we had temporary rules in place by November 2005. We opened the application period in December 2005 and closed it in February 2006. A statewide consensus committee met in June, 2 days in Portland in June of 2006, and made a unanimous recommendation as to the projects to be selected by the Oregon Transportation Commission, which had the ultimate responsibility of selecting the projects. That consensus committee, there were over 30 members of that. They were made up of representatives from the modes, from business, from local government, cities and counties, it was about as complete a cross-section of the state of Oregon as you could have in one room. Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, Central Oregon, Willamette Valley, Portland. It was a very interesting and, I believe, ultimately very productive process. The commission made its ultimate decision in July of 2006. Department sold bonds, $25 million in bonds, in August of 2006 to fund projects that were ready to go right then. The Port of Portland's post-Panamax crane, I think, was one of those that we funded right from the get-go. We're going to sell the balance of the bonds this month, and and have the and have it fully funded. We have reached contractual agreements, I think, with all but I think there were 43 projects selected. We've gone to contract and signed contracts with all but six. There are six that the contracts have actually, I think, been approved and they're in circulation for signatures. And there was one project that that dropped out in the process. What we learned was that, and I guess it's because I participated in it, we thought the consensus committee worked pretty well, but I think it did. And I think that if you asked everybody that participated in it, they thought it was worked well. One of the things about this that was critical to our commission was that this whole process be as open and transparent as possible. Work hard to make it as objective as possible, which is extremely difficult when you're dealing. I mean, you can be objective, but it's extremely difficult to make what I call scientific comparisons between different modes. How do you compare a real project with an aviation project when you're trying to weigh these things? So that was a real challenge, and I think it will continue to be a challenge. But we did it in an open and transparent way. We had vigorous discussions, particularly at the consensus committee level, and as I said, reached a unanimous vote among all the participants in regard to the selection of the project selected. And there were some good projects that didn't make the cut, too. Very good projects. Our staff, I know, did an outstanding job of pulling together something that was totally brand new. I think that we learned a lot. We've got the process up and running. We'll be able to tweak it. Consistent with whatever the legislative decision is, as well as just from what we've learned. We may or may not have the modal groups take a look at the projects before we have the super acts do it. At least at this level, I like the idea of everybody working in a separate silo because I thought it was not good to kind of prejudge how you were going to look at these. I thought it could be a real learning process if we had all these different players look at them and see what they came up with in regard to their processes for making objective selections. And as a result of that, we had different ways of looking at it, but I think we learned a lot, too. We do have to create some more consistency within our super acts as to how they rank things because we did end up with some different ranking methods that were not insurmountable but probably ate up at least a half a day to one day of the consensus committee time resolving those issues. I've talked about the current status. The applicant projects will create about 2,500 construction jobs and 7,400 permanent jobs. 40% of the projects are located at certified industrial sites. There are a lot of projects out there that continue to be addressed. This is the first time the state of Oregon has really, this is the first time the state of Oregon has made a commitment of any type of this nature to this type of a multimodal investment, non-highway investment, basically freight-related investment. That is critical to the future economic health of this state. There is a lot of need out there. There's a lot of way to continue to leverage the state's dollars if Connect Oregon 2 is approved to deliver what I think are projects that are critical to the long-term economic health of the state. So I believe Connect Oregon 1 has been a success and would hope that the legislature would see fit to produce a Connect Oregon 2, and we're prepared to work diligently to implement it.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. I think before I go to questions, I'll go to our director, Mr. Garrett. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chairman Metzger, members of the committee. Matthew Garrett, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I don't want to be redundant. I think Chairman Foster really covered the ABCs of where we have been and where we're heading. But I do want to emphasize a couple points, because this is a success, and this success should be embraced, and I think we're having the conversation about Connect Oregon 2 because of the successful, aggressive, comprehensive, and transparent process that we went through. There's a discipline that's been instilled in the process as well as we go to execute, and Mr. Foster identified the 36 contracts that are signed with the six in the signatory process. We have embedded a discipline, a rigor, milestones which speak to the project moving forward, and if indeed those projects can't run the race, they will be pulled from the race. That is something that was communicated over and over again in our applications, again, vetted through the various criteria, but you need to move this project. This money needs to be invested into the state's economy. We have indeed sold $25 million bonds already, and we stand ready this month to engage the other $75 million of the Connect Oregon money. So we're moving the process and the investment through the process. Stuart hit this, and I think this needs to be noted. There was a healthy appetite at $238 million coming in applications, but I would argue that was very conservative. This was the first time we have run this race. I think the appetite is going to mirror the appetites that we had seen with the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, 4 to 5 times the amount of project application coming in for the money we had. So I embrace this opportunity. We've been successful. The agency stands ready to continue to execute, implement Connect Oregon, and we stand ready to take hold of a new opportunity and execute that program as well. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Garrett. And then before we go to questions, Martin Callery is here from the Port of Coos Bay, and Mr. Callery served on the project selection team for the Freight Advisory Committee, correct?
Yes, I did.
As well as your local ACT, the Southwest ACT. So I thought it'd be great to get a perspective on how that process worked from someone who was intimately involved in it. So welcome.
Chairman Metzger, thank you. I think the project subcommittee of the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee had a unique role to play in that we were the sole entity that had the opportunity to review all of the projects. We weren't limited by mode or region or anything else. And I can tell you through our discussions, we focused very much on the criteria, but we also looked at the benefit to the entire state transportation system. That was our overall goal, was to find projects that truly benefited, that took the criteria, multimodal criteria, and found ways to create a better system that serves the Oregon economy. And I think that was the role that we had, and I believe we were very successful in doing that. Chairman Foster alluded to the fact that there was leverage. I can tell you in the case of a project that I was a proponent for is the money that we got out of Connect Oregon for a rail bridge project in Coos Bay leveraged $8 million in federal funding. And that's just a personal project that I'm involved in. I think that same thing was happening in projects all across the state where multiple partners were coming together to come up with the required partnering to do this, and I think it was very successful. And it made the applicants really examine their ability to meet that criteria laid out in the legislation and to fulfill their obligations for funding.
Well, I appreciate your comments on looking at a statewide perspective, because one of the things I think it's really, really important for this committee and the legislature as a whole is to keep that focus. We understand why we're leveraging programs, particularly if we're taking dollars, making investment dollars today that then become off the table for 20 or 25 years. You know, looking at what is the impact, you know, the measure of the long-term impact from these various projects across the state, because we do have in transportation, and our committee has spent a lot of time on transportation and is a veteran in these issues, we have, the need is so great for a lot of different ways, and so we have to be very, very careful about selecting those projects that are going to help the greater good, regardless of the region that the project emanates from, that there is a connectivity. And And I think the language of the acronym, you know, Connect Oregon, for all the work that this is doing, I think is really, really appropriate. And it should always be a guiding tool in terms of what are we connecting to. Looking at the state's economy, which is why the Freight Advisory Commission was added to the bill, and the discussions I know Senator Starr and I had about that during the putting together of Connect Oregon 1, is to provide a real look beyond the other looks and before the commission, to try and put as many different eyes on and different perspectives on to ensure that, you know, we're being good stewards of future money with the investments we make today, because the need is great and we wish we could just do everything, but we have to be very cautious about that. Thank you very much for those comments. I would I have some questions, but I'm going to start with the committee questions for any of our panelists about Connect Oregon 1 and where we're going with Connect Oregon 2. Senator Decker.
Thank you. Just one question. Thank you for all of your service to the state. A lot of folks just give a lot of time and aren't compensated, and we just all appreciate that. So one of the hallmarks of the Transportation Commission is this depoliticized, put the resources where the greatest need are. And at least the criticism, and it's only slight, that I've heard of Connect Oregon 1 was that in some ways, and perhaps it is we here, got in the way of that very meticulous, depoliticized environment. And that would be the only, I guess, concern I have for Connect Oregon 2 is that we keep what has served the state pretty darn well, I believe, and that is the hallmarks and the institution of the OTC.
Oh, thank you. We strive to be to not be a political body, and we aren't. And we try to make the best decisions that are in the best interest of the citizens of the state of Oregon, and be good stewards to our system. We worked on Connect Oregon. We worked very diligently to be as inclusive as possible, and that was a challenge. But we really wanted to have extensive involvement, and as Senator Metzger said, to have extensive perspective throughout the state on these projects. And then it was extremely important to us that we have that open process of the consensus committee, where we brought everybody into the same room and locked the doors, not literally but almost, and really worked through it and rolled up our sleeves. And I got to tell you, I mean, and Martin was there, but that was I found to be one of the most satisfying experiences. I think Janet was there for some of it. It was one of the most satisfying experiences that I've had in public service, and that was because there were Oregonians sitting around that table and working hard to make, you know, to make the decision that was best for the state of Oregon. They were sensitive to issues around the state. I mean, it's hard to, I mean, how do you compare a project in Ontario to a Port of Portland project, for example? And so those are tough decisions, and I believe in the end that committee really, through the efforts of people like Martin and all the participants all the way around, made the best decision possible. It's not, you know, I think it probably is not, I know it's not perfect, but I think that it was about as good as we could do, and we should always strive for perfection. Don't get me wrong.
Thank you.
Other questions? Is there a start? Any questions?
I want to listen to yours.
Okay. All right. Well, I do have a few, and whoever would like to chip in on this would be valuable. If you could shed some light on a couple of questions. Number one is, and this, Mr. Foster, may be under your direction, but someone else has the answer. There's some questions that we had on Connect Oregon 1 as we look for Connect Oregon 2, to make sure that whatever investments we make as these projects come in, that we are the, for lack of a better phrase, the final link that will make move something to construction. And we do have in Connect Oregon One's original language, you know, that project's ready for construction. But I do know that some members had some questions about some projects in which maybe the Connect Oregon $1 were the lead, you know, not the tail, and as to be utilized to go out and chase other dollars. And to make sure, as a result of that, that the projects don't sit. Now, I think you've got a pretty good definitive list of timing in front of us here, but I would just like for the record to talk about that and then what type of parameters that you have placed in this process so that if you are allocating money and construction is delayed, how long of a delay do you allow before you pull back and say, we're going to the next project on the list because our mission is to get these things done? That would really be helpful, I think.
Well, I think, first of all, I think the first issue is how are we dealing with the matching funds issue. Some of it is up front. The understanding, for example, there might have been a municipality or a private entity that, private municipality, and I know there were some, that had acquired right-of-way, and that was part of their match on, you know, the right-of-way. Okay, we'll put the right-of-way in. It's valued at this. The state will put in the rail improvement, and so we've shared it that way. In other areas, the applicant said that they were going to match it in terms of dollars. And in those situations, the contract that we have entered into with the applicant requires that every expenditure that we be invoiced for expenditures, and that they're at 80%. Remember, it's a 20-80 match. So when we put our 80 in, they put their 20 in, if it's not already in. Okay, I don't believe that there is any project in this list in regard to match dollars I'm virtually certain there's no project in regard to match dollars where the dollars are coming in, where the match would be coming in after the fact. That's just not the way we do business, not the way we contract. When these applications were made, they gave us milestones. I mean, the applications, remember, ready to construct was one of the criteria. So they had to tell us when it would be constructed. I have not looked at the individual contracts, but the department was clearly instructed by our commission that we expected strict compliance with the terms of those applications in regard to project delivery, and that we wanted milestones, and I know these are in the contracts. We want milestones embedded in these contracts to assure us that the projects are moving ahead in the, you know, at the speed that they promised us they would. Mm-hmm. So I believe we have the adequate guidelines in there and controls in there to manage that. I frankly think that some of these projects are complete. A number of them, the Medford Airport, I know, because, you know, they're in the process of, I think they just let bids on that one, and they're going to work on that one. So they do have different timelines, but they're, we are very watchful of that issue.
Thank you. Mr. Garrett, do you have anything to add to that part in terms of where we are in terms of construction expediency and contractual performance?
I think Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, bottom line is Stuart touched it. There is a built-in discipline and rigor and oversight and compliance that playing itself out in the written documents, the agreements we have with these folks, as well as the scrutinies and rigors applied by the ODOT folks as well. They are looking at these milestones. And again, I'm not going to say we're completely unforgiving, but we're running a tight ship here. If indeed, because of the project readiness criteria, our hope was to thin the herd. We weren't getting folks that may limp along through this process. We understood the immediacy of this investment. And so thus the project readiness tried to thin the herd. We come forward with a very specific time frame and those milestones, as Chair Foster indicated, and we'll hold people to there. there may be a legitimacy. Things may push themselves back. But we have delivered a lot of projects at the Oregon Department of Transportation. We know when there's a sound argument that would say, yeah, give us a little more time, we're still going to meet that. And we know when this is a never-ending story. We are applying rigor and scrutiny to these projects. And as I said earlier, if indeed they cannot run the race at the pace they said they could, we will react to that.
Mr. Foster, one of the issues that was brought up by a few folks who are actively involved in the process, and I think there was you alluded to it just a little bit, that as these projects were vetted in these various silos and then moved up for a consideration as it moved up to the commission, there was some complaints by a number of parties that at those levels, those introductory levels, that not everyone who came forward to their particular group who wanted to offer testimony or comment weren't always given quite the same public forum and opportunity that maybe some of the other groups did. And I think one thing that's really important and would just ask for your, you know, public commitment to this is as we move forward on Connect Oregon 2, that as the different groups, modal groups, do their initial venting and moving up to the system is to really articulate again the importance of allowing people at the table to make their comments so that no one feels they're not participating. I know Senator Johnson had pointed out, you know, an example of people had flown up, you know, from Newport and were told they weren't allowed to provide any input. And that wasn't in all the groups. I mean, some was, as you had mentioned, very open. And I think it's very, very critical to this as a statewide project that we make it very clear that, as you know, until those ideas are vetted and maybe rejected or modified, that the public process is really, really important, and trust that the leadership of the Oregon Transportation Commission will be sure that that message is clear and that everybody operates under the same respectful environment for those who are participating in trying to provide transportation projects.
Senator members of the committee, well, what happened on that occasion you mentioned is not the way our department does business or the modal groups over which we had control. It, unfortunately, was that particular instance was something over which we have no control. It was a different agency. But we are absolutely committed to what you said. I mean, that's the way we want to do business. Everybody needs to have their opportunity to present their case. And I guess I can't expand any more on what you said. I agree, and we will do it.
Right, thank you. I think that was pretty important. Senator Starr.
Thank you. Three quick comments, questions, and hopefully we'll have time, and if not, we can continue this conversation and the department can get back to us. I'm always surprised and frustrated in this process how long everything takes. The legislature passes a bill, a law, and it just seems like it takes forever. Here we are 2 years later, year and a half later, and we're now selling the bonds to take care of this. The question is, CO2, are we going to build on some of the information that was provided us, you all, in the first go around, or do we have to run through the entire same process, and is it going to take us as long to vet the projects and get these dollars out the door? That's number one. Don't answer. Let me just go through the other questions. Okay. I see Matt's taking notes. Mr. Chair Foster, you mentioned that the process was near perfect. I'd be interested in knowing what ideas you have to improve it specifically. And then the last one is a question on amount. The governor's talked in his budget another $100 million. Director Garrett, you might want to not answer this question, understanding your role, but does it make sense to maybe raise the bar a little bit and go for a higher amount? And then the last comment is on the politics. I shouldn't surprise anybody that there's politics in Oregon, in this building, and with all due respect, Mr. Chair, I believe that there's politics at the commission. I think that's just people come to things from a frame of reference and from maybe even just a part of the state. So I understand that, and you know, I believe that there's an attempt. You know, you strive to do what's best for the entire state at all times. But I think, you know, I think we recognize that at times different things happen, and I think the goal is to serve the entire state. And I think that happens, but I think we're foolish to think that politics doesn't play a role. Those are my comments. There's some questions in there. Have at it.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I'll start with the last one first. Anytime that you're making decisions of the magnitude that are made with Connect Oregon, and you're dealing with allocating it around the state of Oregon in an equitable manner, and the politics does have some relevance in it, okay? And appropriately so. And I shouldn't, I think I shouldn't have called it, it was really bad for me to say this, a near perfect process or whatever I said that. I mean, we tried hard to do what was right, okay? And we tried hard to be sensitive to the regional needs, maybe the rural needs would be a better way to put that. I think I'd put it rural needs as well as urban needs. And how do you say, okay, we need to allocate X number of dollars to some rural projects versus our alternative is to allocate that amount to a project in a highly urban area where it's clearly a very needy project. And so, there's some equitable balancing that takes place in this process, and I believe it has to. And so maybe that's one way to characterize that is there is a political nature to that. As far as moving the the process ahead faster, I think we had some people that were complaining, some applicants, we were moving it ahead too fast, which we always are real tickled about.
Too bad.
You know, the government moving too fast. I know in OTIA process we've had those issues too. But I think that we need to move it ahead at an appropriate speed. We did learn a lot. We have a lot of systems in place that will enable us to deal with it more efficiently. The one thing we're all interested in is making sure that we've got a good pool of applicants. And so that's a consideration. If you move it too fast, maybe you don't pick up as many applicants as you should. So I think that's one of the balancing factors. And I don't have the answer to it today, but I mean, it's one of the things everybody needs to think about when we're putting that timeline together. Have we set it up in such a manner as we're going to get some good applications? Because that's what we all want. But I do think it'll move ahead, at a somewhat faster pace, but you just have a process that takes some time. Can we improve on it? I got to tell you that I'm real comfortable with the criteria that came out of the first bill that I thought it gave us and the consensus committee and the modal groups the ability to make the decisions that they made, which created some flexibility. As I said earlier, I don't think you can get too scientific in this stuff. I mean, I don't know how you compare. Some of this stuff is just apples and oranges, and it's extremely difficult to compare. One thing that made me and does make me nervous is that 15% threshold per region. Down in my region, Region 3, we barely went over that threshold. I think we hit 16 million in Region 3. And we had one big project for 7 million. If that project would have dropped off the map, we would have had a few, but we wouldn't have had anywhere near $7 million or $6 million worth of good projects to fill it up. And so we would have been short that we would have been mandated to spend 15%, and we would have been facing some projects that none of us would be happy with. So that's, you know, I understand why those thresholds are in there. I think it has something to do with that last issue we talked about, but we've got to be real careful about that. I would be more comfortable if it was down to 10 or 12% range, because and that doesn't mean that we wouldn't. I mean, I don't know how you got to see the rare projects before you can have any idea how you'd array it, but that arbitrary level that high concerns me a little bit. Okay. The amount, I am comfortable with the $100 million. I would be fine with more. I again would be, if we had more, I'd be really concerned about that percentage threshold, because I think then that really might get real dicey in some areas. So I think that I've answered your question, Senator.
Matt, do you have any suggestions, particularly on the points of how can we improve the process?
Right. Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I think just a couple things, and I promise I'll do my best to answer your specific question. But I do want to go back to the timeline. It is important for me, because I say it often and I say it with confidence, that we did run an aggressive, comprehensive, and transparent process. Now, a comprehensive, transparent process is going to take some time. It's just the nature of beast. And again, the governor signed the bill August 28, 2005. We had an administrative rule activity that played itself out in November. The applications were due in February. We do the vetting process where we have a public hearing in June. The commission gavels down in July. And we issue $25 million of bonds in August. Now, the remaining part of the $75 million we spoke about playing itself out now, we were somewhat put on ice because of some ballot measures that were affecting potential long-term investments. Right, wrong, or indifferent. That was the time frame that kind of held us up from truly making the investments all at once, because there's an issue of timing there and an issue of politics. And politics is not a dirty word to me. I think it's a noble cause, and it does weave its way through and within all our processes. Now, we've run the race once. I think that will improve the timeline and process. We know what to do with regard to the administrative rules. The process is known to us to some extent. We have the formats in terms of, we have a unit that's up and running monitoring and with regard to compliance and oversight. We have, the formats. The contractual format itself takes some time to make sure that you have everything you have you need in there. And I think those, again, will fast forward our conversation. So I think we've learned the lesson on that. With regard to how we improve it, again, we've run the race once. We've vetted this stuff. I think it's whetted the appetite. I think people see the opportunity. I think the conversation that Senator Metzger indicated, how do you connect things up? Really, this is Connect Oregon. Look at the title of the bill. How do you connect things up? How do you link it? Let's have those robust conversations. That'll benefit the overall conversation here, and I look forward to that coming forward. It's not a perfect process, but it was a damn fine process that yielded good projects for the state of Oregon. I would argue that, and again, I look forward to this conversation.
Thank you.
Can I have a follow-up answer?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, one of the things I do think that we need to tweak a little bit, just give you one example, and we need to be thinking about this sort of thing, is that this is just one example. The Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad, which serves the port of Coos Bay, originates in Eugene. And that line that runs from Coos Bay to Eugene, a large portion of it is in Region 2, okay? And it's in dire need of improvement. And the way we structured the process, Region 2 didn't have any incentive. This is a project that benefited Region 3 if you did the rail improvements. And I'm not saying they should have been done at this stage. I don't think they should have been done at this stage, but I'm thinking of, but the rail improvement portion was up in Region 2. They didn't have any real incentive to support that because it didn't do anything for them. It did something for Coos Bay. So that's one of the things we're going to have to think a little more carefully about, that we don't get trapped by something like like that in the next process. So I think as we go back and we, if we get a Connect Oregon 2, those of us that have participated in Connect Oregon 1 in that process are going to need to sit down and really think through carefully some of these issues so that we don't get trapped into a situation where you have a really needy project and it doesn't have the support.
Thank you. I think anytime you do language changes to improve something, sometimes some people's opinion is that the improvement is a detriment. So with that as a caveat, you know, one thing, and I think we can talk with Chairman Beyer and others in the House, too, on this, and Chairman Johnson in Ways and Means, but relating to your comment and Senator Starr's comment on this issue, and I think that was illustrative of your situation, what if happened, and now we're out of statutory compliance, but not because of the best efforts of the project, but because of the or the commitment of the commission, but because of this. You know, I wonder if maybe there may be some modification in the language referring to that portion, assuming we were to keep the same regionalization, which is always a political battle and why we ended up where we did. Maybe we might stretch the envelope a little bit on that, change the language to as much as practicable to each of those percentages, so that in the case of that kind of a situation, you don't find yourself out of compliance and upset. And one thing, and we have a real advantage, I believe, this year, in that under our retiming of the legislature, we will be back in session in February. So probably about the time that you are really cranking up with a litany of projects, which, as you know, you would are going to be welcome back to the committee to tell us how you are and where you are and how it's working, which I think is in itself is a good governor on the process, because, you know, everyone knows Matt's going to have to come back, and Stuart's going to have to come back, and Martin's going to come back, and I want to be able to tell good stories, and we know that. So I think that's a real helpful process, too. If there are some additional thoughts on as we craft the bill, I have heard some from others, and trying to find direction, I thought your suggestions are very good on that. I do believe that overall the majority of projects are really, really good. I think our concern is as we move forward, we want to keep that scrutiny so that we can continue to say that and not lose track of our responsibility to really provide a good transportation system. Any other questions for the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
We have one other activity for today, and that's some bill drafts. We have four of them to introduce as committee bills.
Do you want a motion?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I move that we introduce LC 2392, LC 1872, LC 1869, LC 2782 as committee bills.
Okay, thank you. Senator Starr has moved LC 2392, LC 1872, LC 1869, LC 2782 as committee bills. Again, this does not say that you are in support or, you know, opposition to the bills, but allow them to be introduced for discussion. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Committee, a reminder, we are not here tomorrow. Senator Starr and I are going to be at the White House trying to get some money, right? Good luck. So we will not be meeting tomorrow. We will be meeting on Monday. And just a reminder, a week from, you heard first read today our resolution with the Senate from the state of Washington, and our meeting will be a week from Friday in Portland from 11 to 2 o'clock. That'll be a very historic meeting with the Washington Senate. So we're adjourned.